from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Nell Larson. Well, during the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Mark Derricksweiler, the vice chair and legislative coordinator of the Oklahoma chapter of the Sierra Club. We'll be talking about Scott Pruitt and what his role at the head of the APA means for the future of that agency and our existing environmental protections.
That, and in the second half of the show, we're going to catch up on a lot of items in the news. Of course, there's no shortage of things going on with respect to the environment. Out of Washington, out of Salt Lake City, out of the capital here in our state, locally, et cetera. So we're going to kind of bring you up on some news items with respect to some additional congressional reviews going on regulations coming out of the EPA, or the EPA, the previous administration tried
Absolutely.
To launch. We'll give you some news on that. We'll take a look at, an item I wanted to cover for a while about the feral pigs in this country.
We're finally getting back to the feral pigs. Critical breaking news.
It kind of matches with some of the other items we're covering.
So that's right.
How they're running hog wild.
Amok.
Around the country. Yeah, there you go. So that, and maybe some, maybe you have some news items too now, but we'll get to all of that in the second half of the show.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments or questions to our Facebook page at KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, this is The Bruce, Dumpster Guardian at Recycle Utah. Did you know Americans demolish nearly 250 homes each year? Instead of demolishing a building, contact the Reuse People of America to deconstruct the building for you and donate the salvage materials to Recycle Utah.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And on the phone with us for the first half of the show today is Mark Derricksweiler, the vice chair and legislative coordinator of the Oklahoma chapter of the Sierra Club. He comes to the Sierra Club after a 40-year background of service at the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality, where he recently retired from. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
Well, we originally contacted you all because we wanted to talk a little bit about Scott Pruitt and his role at the EPA. But before we dig too much into that, tell us a little bit about your role with Sierra Club and your history there in Oklahoma.
Well, I've been involved with Sierra Club off and on since about 1979. Mainly on water issues, but I originally got our legislative lobbying program here at our state capitol started back in the middle to late 1980s. As you can probably imagine, that's a pretty tough job here in Oklahoma.
Sure.
It's gotten a lot tougher over the years, but we do support the only full-time environmental lobbyist at the state capitol here in Oklahoma City. So I'm a volunteer, and I mainly work with our membership and the general public trying to get the word out and get people informed about what happens at the Capitol to support the efforts of our lobbyists there, get people to interact with their state legislators and build support for pro-environment measures here at the state Capitol.
So tell us a little bit about what you did with Oklahoma DEQ. For decades, you worked with the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality, correct?
I did. I started in 1976 as a staff engineer And when I retired, I was the engineering manager in charge of our water quality planning section. So what we did was look at water quality data that was collected from all across the state and compare that to the water quality standards, which set the goals for what the level of quality in the stream or in the lake should be, and identify those streams, rivers, lakes that don't meet the standards. So the ones that don't meet the standards, then we would conduct the detailed studies of where the pollution was coming from, whether it was out of a pipe from a city or an industry or some other facility, or what we call non-point sources, which are things that are washed off of the ground from agriculture operations or cities or urban areas or construction sites or other things like that. So we would do the studies to look at all those different sources of whatever pollutant was causing the problem to come up with a sort of a pollution budget. They're called total maximum daily load, or TMDL in the vernacular of right. the EPA rules, at least as they still exist now.
Sure.
Right.
And come up with basically a plan to get these rivers and lakes back into compliance with the standards. That was the main thing that we did, but I also was the manager over our wetlands program, where we reviewed Corps of Engineers permits that affected wetlands. I also managed the stormwater runoff control program that applied to cities and construction sites and industrial facilities.
That's a big job.
It's a lot of different things. Planning is pretty broad, but I had a good staff of scientists and engineers, and we've faced some pretty serious budget challenges here in Oklahoma, but we did the best we could.
Good.
Well, with such a long history, you know, in Oklahoma with these environmental issues, you have an interesting perspective on Scott Pruitt. You've probably been watching him for much longer than the rest of us. So talk a little bit about Scott Pruitt's history in your state.
Well, he started out as a state legislator. I guess sort of his claim to fame was that he was the owner of a minor league team, sports team here in the state. After he retired or got out of the legislature, he ran for attorney general and was elected. He's in his second term now.
Right. Right, and when did he start, when was he the lead for the DEQ, the administrator for Oklahoma DEQ?
Well, he was never in charge of the DEQ. The Attorney General's office is completely separate from the DEQ.
Okay, but he had a large role in affecting environmental policy in the state.
Well, he could. His predecessor and most of the previous attorneys general were involved in environmental issues and enforcement of environmental laws in the state. The first thing Scott Pruitt did when he was elected attorney general was dismantle the Environmental Protection Unit there in his office. So there was a dedicated team of environmental lawyers that were responsible for working with the state agencies and assisting with enforcement of the environmental laws, especially as it relates to criminal actions. So the first thing he did was disband that group and form a new group that he called the Federalism Unit, which was the team that he put together to challenge EPA and other parts of the federal government for what he considered overreach. So really, the main thrust of Scott Pruitt since he was Attorney General in Oklahoma was fighting EPA and fighting environmental laws, not standing up for citizens to protect them from the effects of pollution or aggressively enforcing environmental laws.
Okay, so what would you say were the impacts, the consequences of that decision of dismantling, among other things, dismantling that section of his office that pursued environmental polluters?
Well, there's been very little that's happened since he was in charge of the office. We've tried to, after this has all come up, we've tried to do some research through open records requests and searching the state archives. So previous attorneys general always filed an annual report mm-hmm. every year that sort of summarized the actions that they had taken during the previous year, not just for environmental issues. Those were covered, but everything else that the office did. There haven't been any of those filed since Scott Pruitt took office, so it's hard to really get a handle on what he has done. But in the environmental area, other than contesting EPA rules that are meant to protect people and protect the planet, he really hasn't done much. There was one case that he was involved with, some oil companies that had leaking underground storage tanks. And there's a fund that's set up to help reimburse some of the cost to clean those up.
Right.
And he charged a couple of the oil companies with trying to get reimbursed out of that fund after they'd already been paid by their insurance companies. So it was really more of a financial fraud kind of a case than an environmental case, although it involved underground storage tanks.
Sure.
Well, we keep hearing that, he's sued the EPA 14 times over air and water regulations. Can you give us an idea of, an example or two of some of those specific cases?
Well, of course, probably the two that are most famous were the suit over the Clean Power Plan, mm-hmm. which yeah. would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from utilities and power plants. Here in Oklahoma, we're a big provider of wind energy in this state. We recently moved up to the third in the country after California and Texas.
Wow.
So we produce a lot of wind power already. And as far as Oklahoma goes, we were pretty much already in compliance with the Clean Power Plan
right.
requirements because of the wind energy that we have. But nevertheless, he filed suit claiming, again, that this was a vast EPA overreach. The other case probably that's got the most attention is his lawsuit against what they call the Waters of the U.S. rule, which was EPA's attempt to clearly define what streams and what bodies of water are subject to the Clean Water Act. So this really goes all the way back. The Clean Water Act was first adopted back in 1972. And in the early years, it was pretty clear that EPA was going to need to regulate discharges and impacts to small streams because everything's connected. A small creek runs into a larger stream that runs into a river that runs into a lake and a bigger river and eventually the ocean. But that's all connected, so you can't arbitrarily say streams that don't always have water in them are not going to be regulated. If we let industries or cities or anybody else dump their wastewater unregulated into a small stream because we claim that that's no longer a water of the U.S., that's going to cause big problems on downstream. So originally, that's the way the Clean Water Act worked. Pretty much any discharge into any kind of a stream or a wetland was going to be regulated. The problem came when polluters and others started challenging this, and there were several confusing Supreme Court decisions. And the most confusing one ended in a 4-4-1 split among the 9 justices. So there was no majority opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have heard this term about significant nexus. If a water has a significant nexus to a navigable stream, that it should be regulated. That wasn't something that EPA dreamed up. That was something that was added by the lawyers and the judges at the Supreme Court. This significant nexus test came from the Supreme Court. So the Waters of the U.S. rule was EPA's attempt to define how do you determine whether there's a significant nexus between a particular point on a small stream or any body of water and how it relates to the biology and the chemistry and everything else of streams there and on downstream. Without that rule, it was more a case of EPA or the Corps of Engineers having to go out and do a detailed site-specific study to try and decide if there's a significant nexus, whatever they think that means. So the rule was an attempt to clarify all that.
Right.
It's not really an overreach or an expansion of EPA authority. It's really a restoration of the authority that EPA previously had before these confusing court decisions,
and now it's under review. It's not going to be put into place for 60, 90, 120 days. It'll be kind of delayed, deferred as it goes under quote unquote review and additional public comment.
So, right. The rule was actually finalized, and Scott Pruitt, along with some other state attorneys general, filed the lawsuit and got a restraining order or temporary injunction,
right,
putting implementation of the rule on hold, so it hasn't actually been implemented. But you're right, one of President Trump's executive orders directed the agency to review that rule and make revisions to it. So if they do that legally, that's a long, complicated process of scientific study and justification and public review before the rule becomes public or in effect again.
Well,
so they have to go through all that for a revision to the rule as well.
Right.
For those listeners that may be just joining us, we want to reintroduce you quickly. We're talking with Mark Dirschweiler, who's the vice chair and legislative coordinator of the Oklahoma chapter of the Sierra Club. And because of his long history in the state of Oklahoma, we're talking to him about the new EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt. So, Mark, you know, looking at the EPA right now, what has Scott Pruitt taken on first, and how is that going?
Well, it sounds like the EPA budget may be the first big issue that comes up. The Trump administration has proposed, I think, a 25% cut overall to the EPA budget, but they're not trying to cut all the programs equally. So I think I heard Mr. Pruitt the other day say that he liked the Superfund program, which cleans up contaminated chemical toxic pollution sites, and the brownfield site, which is a funding program to clean up abandoned industrial sites so that they can be redeveloped, and there may be a few others. So if, for example, the funding program for clean water infrastructure, this may be part of the Trump infrastructure initiative, funding support for things like drinking water treatment plants or sewage treatment plants.
Right.
So if those kinds of programs are held harmless or not reduced and there's a 25% cut overall, the other water programs and air programs and pesticide programs are going to take a huge hit.
Right. I checked into this this morning, and over the past 8 years, let's say, the EPA's budget, annual budget, has averaged about $8.2 billion. The proposed budget under this new administration may have it down to as low as around $6.1, $6.2 billion. That's a budget that hasn't been seen in EPA since 1991, okay? And then a 25% reduction in workforce from the workforce right now is about 15,000 people. So maybe up to 4,000 people losing their jobs under this new proposed budget and cuts. All of that, which also Scott Pruitt seems to endorse.
Yeah, if those kinds of budget cuts are actually put into place and the Congress goes along with it, it would be a huge setback to being able to keep up with just all the information that comes in, and as well as the enforcement of what remains of the existing laws.
We keep hearing these really bold claims about, like, dismantling the EPA or, you know, doing away with it in any recognizable form. To what extent is that really possible, and how would that happen?
Well, I'm not sure how it would happen, but it would take action by Congress to do away with or radically change the basic environmental laws that the agency enforces, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Toxic Substances Control Act, and all the others. Those are federal laws that are all on the books today. Now, the agency itself is an administrative agency that actually was formed by President Nixon back in those days. So I'm not sure what it would take to actually do away with the agency, but we live in strange times, so I'm not going to say it can't happen.
Right, and I've kind of come up with four D's that the EPA, Scott Pruitt, you roll your eyes. Well, my usual letter.
Cheesy.
Are you ready for this?
All right. Right.
Delay, defer, defund, and then dismantle. And we already talked about the delay part. They can take rules that are proposed or ready to go in the books and delay the implementation of them. Like you say, Mark, you can defer that. You can also, just put them aside and just not bother with them. That's happened in the Bush administration when they just kind of made clean water or clean air issues, just kind of put them on the back burner. You can defund, and that's the biggest way of kind of taking the teeth out of the EPA. Is you don't have give them any money, you don't have any, you have less money for and staff for oversight. That's what EPA does. They do a lot of oversight and monitoring of ongoing programs. So those are the three D's: delay, defer, defund, and then dismantle. Like you say, now I mean literally just kind of shut programs down or so.
Right. Well, Scott Pruitt claims or wants to claim that these should all be responsibilities of the states.
Yes.
Anyway, not the federal government. We tried that back in the 60s. States were responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially where he wants to take us back, where rivers were on fire and states were in a race to the bottom to come up with the least restrictive environmental rules to recruit industry and things like that. So that's his vision of environmental protection.
Right.
Well, that's so interesting as well with that interaction with the states, because the other thing we're hearing is that the federal government doesn't want California to be able to enforce some of the stronger environmental regulations with regard to, like, tailpipe emissions and things
right.
like that. So how do those interact? How does that line up?
You mean they're hypocrites.
Yeah. There you go. You're right.
They don't line up. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. But on the larger side of it is that if you turn regulations over to states will then also do the same thing. They have to fund these programs. They don't have the money in many cases. So they will defund their environmental programs. And what you end up getting is kind of a balkanization of environmental rules and regulations and a race to the bottom.
Right. And we know that rivers don't end at the state line,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
air doesn't end at the state line. States impact each other's, and that's one of the main reasons that these federal laws were put into place, to standardize the rules and the requirements across state borders. One of the biggest issues we've had here in Oklahoma that I was involved with were the impacts from the poultry industry in Arkansas on the scenic rivers in Oklahoma, because those rivers actually start in Arkansas, flow to the west across the state line into Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
and there's a huge number of poultry operations along the river on the Arkansas side. There's some in Oklahoma as well. And this has been an ongoing issue that's been to the Supreme Court once already. There was a landmark decision there that basically said upstream states do have to take actions to meet the water quality standards of states that are downstream.
Right.
The previous attorney general, before Mr. Pruitt, actually filed a lawsuit against the large poultry corporations to try and get them to clean up their act. After he left office and Mr. Pruitt came in, that lawsuit, it's been almost 7 years now, and we're still waiting for a decision.
Wow.
And excuse me, and including that, there is a cross-state pollution rule for air quality standards for ozone that is now under the Congressional Review Act. And that's an act that allows Congress to literally rescind the previous administration's rules that were established. And so the Congressional Review Act has right now 49 resolutions that are under consideration to be rescinded. I have a whole list here of some EPA rules for accidental release, prevention requirements on the Clean Air Act, some DOI, Department of Interior rules for stream protection, which was kind of addressing surface mining and reclamation sites, DOI rule for the taking of wildlife on the National Wildlife Refuges in Alaska. There's 49 of these rules that are either under EPA, DOI, BLM, that are under review. And if Congress rescinds these rules, they can never be reintroduced again as the same rule. They have to be refashioned entirely. This is something that has been used once since it was enacted back in the late 90s. And now this administration has introduced 49 so far as of March 3rd. So this is the world where, like you say, these are strange times, Mark. These are our, like, through-the-looking-glass kind of times.
Well, along these interstate issues, one of the other lawsuits that he filed was on behalf of one of the large public utility here in Oklahoma that had to do with the Clean Air Interstate rule, the regional haze rule. Mm-hmm. So OG&E had proposed to put scrubbers on some of their coal-fired power plants rather than converting them to natural gas or phasing them out for wind, which is what the other utilities decided to do. They wanted to fight the rule instead, and Scott Pruitt took their side, not the side of the people or air quality in Oklahoma, because this was specifically directed at air quality in some federal wilderness areas and some other protected areas here in Oklahoma. But he took the side of the utilities and argued that all the way to the Supreme Court and basically lost. That was one of the cases that he lost. Hmm.
Well, we got a few minutes left. Again, you've worked for the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of Oklahoma for decades. Oklahoma is obviously a very red state. But the folks at the DEQ, just like the folks here at Utah's DEQ, you know, have the environment in mind, and you work really hard to try to make a difference. I mean, in the state of Oklahoma, did you feel like you made a difference?
Well, yeah, and, you know, when we would get pressure from the polluters to do something that really shouldn't be done, you always had that EPA backstop there. You could always say, well, you know, look, EPA makes us do this. That was the rationale for a lot of the good work that we did there. It's required by the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act. There's no way around it.
Right.
And if we lose that backstop for states like Oklahoma or Utah and some others, it's just going to make it much more difficult.
Right. And again, that's, yeah, the backstop. The EPA sets the policies and the rules and the standards, and the states implement them. And like you say, without that backstop, then the states can implement whatever they want.
Right.
And again, you get that race to the bottom as far as what states will relax their regulations the most to attract smokestack industry, let's say. So there's a whole series of consequences that unfolds without a federal backstop in the form of the EPA. All right, Mark. So let's finish up with the Sierra Club. What can you do? What can our listeners do with respect to the work you do with the Sierra Club and being more engaged in this situation?
Well, Sierra Club is unique in a few ways among the environmental organizations. We are a national organization, but we're also organized statewide and locally all across the country. There are local groups in most major population centers, and those people are all doing great work. All of the other state chapters around the country have some kind of a state legislative lobbying program at their capital. So we're engaged at the national level, the state level, and the local level. We don't just work. We do sponsor a whole slate of trips to the outdoors to get people out to see what it is that we're trying to save and get them invested in that way. And we get involved in politics. Other than the League of Conservation Voters, which is pretty much all they do is politics, we do endorse candidates at the national level and at the state level. We hold legislators accountable for their actions. Here and in most other states, we publish an environmental scorecard every year that summarizes major environmental votes and how people came down on the issues. So I'd encourage everybody to seek out their own local Sierra Club organization. It's a great way to get plugged in.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us this morning.
Well, you're quite welcome. I appreciate you having me on.
That was Mark Derschweiler, the Vice Chair and Legislative Coordinator of the Oklahoma Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll cover some items in the news, including a state of Michigan announcing a ban on plastic bands. Got it? Oh, boy. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over three-fourths of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Renato Saltz, proud to support KPCW. At Saltz Plastic Surgeons Pavitoria, we offer cosmetic surgeries of the face and body, as well as non-surgical procedures such as CoolSculpting, laser resurfacing, Botox, and fillers. More information at saltzplasticsurgery.com or 655-6612.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. And it's time for some items in the news. We have a bunch we wanted to catch up on that kind of pile up over the weeks here.
That's right.
So we'll start with one of your items, Nell.
Yeah, and this is not so much like a breaking news item as a really, really cool tool that's available with a bunch of data online. And it comes from the Yale program on climate change communication. And you can Google that. It'll take you to the website.
To where? Yale?
The Yale Climate Change Communication nonprofit? Program. Yes. Yale University.
Oh, Yale. Yeah.
New
okay.
Haven, Connecticut. My alma mater.
Yes.
All right. Full disclosure
shameless
there.
Plug. Go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, Google this, find the link. It'll take you to a map of our country. And it's split out by county as the default, but you can also choose like a metro area or congressional districts or states. And then you can see the survey responses to about 20 different questions to understand how the people in each county feel or think about these things. So, you know, whether or not people understand that global warming is happening, is it caused mostly by human activities? Do people believe that most scientists think global warming is happening? Do they trust climate scientists? And then also things like risk perceptions. Are you worried about it? Do you believe that the impacts are already being seen? Are people already being harmed by this? Do you talk about, you know, global warming or climate change ever. You know, do you talk about it at least occasionally?
Yeah.
And so you can get all of this data down to county. And
really?
So I had a lot of fun fiddling with this and looking, of course, at our state here of Utah.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of pulling up the global warming is happening by county right now. And one thing that I was interested to see is that I could only find three counties on the entire map in the entire U.S. where fewer than 50% or less than 50% of the population believes that global warming is happening.
Three counties.
Only three counties.
Let
so
me
everywhere
guess.
Else. Yeah. Okay,
is this part of the
two
quiz?
Of these are in our state.
No way.
Yeah.
And is any in Oklahoma?
No. Millard County, Utah, and Emory County, Utah. And the other county that I found here is like this tiny little county, Grant County in West Virginia.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, okay. I knew you were going to name
All
it.
Right. So say that again. So three counties in this entire country.
Yeah.
Have less than 50% mm-hmm. of those individuals in that county who were queried, believe that climate change mm-hmm. is human caused, or whatever
exactly.
the question is.
Exactly.
Okay.
This in particular was that global warming is happening, but you can pull up.
Okay.
You could pull up the data. For example.
And again, they went out and they did some type of polling or some type of querying. I mean, how do they get that information?
They have a lot of information on the website about the methodology.
Okay.
And so if you're interested, you can dig into that. And they have, you know, about the survey. They show the survey questions that, you know, people were asked. And so you can really get a ton of information from this. You can kind of like dig in as much as you want. You can even download their data sets
right.
if you want to look at this
stuff. Could we pull up Summit County real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
So what percentage of us in Summit County?
In Summit County, global warming is happening. Let me just put my clicker. Good thing I know my geography here. Okay.
Yeah,
in Summit County, Utah, global warming, 71% of people believe that global warming is happening, which is 1% above the national average of 70%.
The national average is 70%.
It is.
Wow.
It is.
That's impressive.
And then in our county, let's see, we can see global warming is caused mostly by human activities, and it looks like 53% of us in Summit County are confident about that, and that's actually one below the national average.
Okay, so mm-hmm. on average, so that's 1% below mm-hmm. national average.
We're one of the only counties in Utah where more than half of the population, you know, understands that this is being caused by humans. The rest of the country, that's a little different.
So the majority of people in the country believe that yes, we're getting warmer,
mm-hmm.
but a thin majority believe that it's human caused.
Yes.
All right.
Mm-hmm. 53%.
53%.
Yeah.
So there are probably a lot of counties around the country who don't think mm-hmm. that humans are the cause of the warming we're experiencing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
So
there's a little bit of a disconnect on that piece of data still, but that makes sense because, you know, first scientists were focusing on the climate science itself, and then it was the cause of, you know, what that climate change is. And so I think that there's probably that lag in public opinion.
Right. And then there's even a third question that you kind of dig a little deeper. And it's like, okay, if you think that humans are causing it, what percentage of the warming mm-hmm. is being caused by humans? Because I know some people will say, well,
right.
80 to 90% of the warming is caused by humans. And others
right.
will say, well, I believe that humans are causing or contributing.
Right.
Contributing to the problem. But
right.
it's maybe like 30
like
or 40%.
Or
and it's
yeah.
not enough to really do anything
yeah.
about.
So one of the other questions that was fascinating to me was whether or not people believe that global warming would harm future generations. And 70% of the people in our county believe that it will. So even those, and this is, you know, nationally, let's see what the percentage was there. Again, it's 70%.
Mm-hmm.
So people, even though they don't necessarily think that humans are causing it or understand the science behind that, 70% of the country thinks, yeah, this is going to be a problem for future generations.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't want to spend our entire, like, 15 minutes left on this, but it's a really fascinating map, and we can post a link to that.
Well, unfortunately, our new administration and Scott Pruitt and others fall under that 30%.
Right, which is so interesting. Like, 70% of our country, the large majority of the country, understands that this is happening, and more than half of the country sees that it's human caused.
It's human caused. But I bet less than half of the country thinks that we should be doing a lot about it, much about it.
Okay, so there's a policy support section here, okay. So you can get a sense
and
of
again,
like
where
what
is
people
this website?
Think we would do.
Is it way too long?
Yeah, it's climatecommunication.yale.edu.
climatecommunication.yale.edu.
That's right.
Okay, mm-hmm. Wrote that down. Okay, I'm sorry. So yeah. What was, right, they have a regulatory section?
I think they called it like a policy support. Okay. So do you believe that, you know, research should be funded into renewable energy sources? Should we regulate CO2 as a pollutant? Should we set strict CO2 limits on existing coal-fired power plants? Should we require utilities to produce 20% electricity from renewable sources? So they're kind of floating some of the, right, you know, more popular policy ideas out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you could pick a county, or what's the national average,
yeah,
with respect to?
All right. For CO2 as a pollutant, the national average is 75%. That carbon dioxide should be regulated as a pollutant, which is interesting. I would have guessed much lower. That is surprising to me. And let me pull up the counties here. So okay. Summit County, 73% of us think that.
Think that some policies.
Think that CO2, carbon dioxide, should be regulated as,
wow,
a pollutant.
All right. Well, that's surprising.
Yeah.
All right. That's very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting.
What does Millard County think?
Let's see.
Is there any county that
57% of them think that CO2 should be regulated as a pollutant.
Less than half of that county believes that warming's even happening, but yet more than half believe it. Okay.
I don't know what to say.
Maybe
I'd
there's
have to
a
dig
big
into
plus
the,
minus factor to these, some of these
survey
numbers.
Results here. Okay. Do a data download. But it's fun. You can see the areas that are really forward thinking on the climate stuff. You can see, you know, states that have certain policies will have overwhelming responses in one direction. And it's really fun to look at if,
cool,
you're interested in this stuff.
All right. We're going to explore this a little more then going forward. This is nice data. Well done.
Yeah.
Thank you, Yale.
Thank you, Yale Center for Climate Change Communication.
All right. Let's go on to next news item.
Yeah.
All right. While we're on a roll here, this is about plastic bags in the state of Michigan. This is really a new law in Michigan will prohibit local governments from banning, regulating, or imposing fees on the use of plastic bags and other containers. So you heard this right. It's not a ban on plastic bags. It's a ban on banning plastic bags. So if you're a community and you want to ban single-use plastic bags or such, in Michigan, you're not allowed to do that.
So it is, what was the motivation for this? Is this like from the plastic bag lobby, or was there a lot of action against single-use plastic bags in Michigan?
Well,
I know that because of Lake Michigan, because of the Great Lakes there, plastic bags are a real concern.
A huge problem.
As are those microplastics and things we've talked about.
Yeah, well, mostly it was lobbyists for the food industry or for the restaurant industry who convinced the state legislators there that a ban on single-use plastic or plastic bags in general would harm them in some fashion, right? It would be a burden. And again, like Mark said, overreach. That's the common word used by conservatives, Republicans, who with respect to environmental regulations. This is overreach. This is the nanny state, you know, and if you ban plastic bags. So the state of Michigan, they're not the first state that's done this. Other states, including, I think, Arizona and Idaho, have also banned. Idaho, Arizona, and Missouri all have enacted similar laws banning bans on plastic. So this isn't the first time this has happened. So really interesting. And like you say, here's a state that's surrounded by bodies of water that have visible, tangible impacts from plastics in their waters. So, Michigan, well done. It was a new law just enacted, last week by Lieutenant Governor Brian Cowley, because the governor, Rick Snyder, was away on vacation. So, you know, that's what's happening there in Michigan. Ban on ban. Hopefully, hopefully no one from the Utah legislature listens to our show, so they won't catch on to this.
They won't pick up any ideas.
Yeah, any ideas for their next legislative session. All right, let's take. We need to keep going.
There's no time.
I've run out of underwriters.
Power on through. Well, one piece that I saw in the news just yesterday that I thought was really interesting is that, we've all been following the story on Volkswagen's emissions and the fraud behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a study now showing that Volkswagen's emissions fraud may affect the mortality rate in Europe. So they're actually taking the step and looking at, okay, how the emissions are differing and what that means for human health. So from 2008 to 2015, they sold 11 million diesel cars worldwide that were rigged with software that cheated the emissions test. So it would only run the full emissions control system if the car sensed that it was being tested. So these scientists at MIT are estimating that about 1,200 people in Europe will die prematurely, each losing as much as a decade of life because of excess emissions from 2.6 million affected cars sold just in Germany. So they were focusing on Germany and then surrounding countries. And here, obviously, this system is illegal and Volkswagen is having to follow up. But in Europe, I guess it falls into this really kind of gray area legally, and so they're not seeing the same response here. So they're gonna
die 10 years earlier? That's what it says.
1,200 people.
1,200 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's just interesting to make that connection. We think about it as, you know, it impacts the value of people's cars and it impacts...
Or my view shed.
Exactly.
You know, it makes things hazy.
Right.
Well, it does do that, and it also results in real physical harm.
Mm-hmm. Right, those nitrogen.
Ask anyone with asthma. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it. All right, ready for another one?
Ready. I hope it's better news than that.
I don't know. Let me look around.
Maybe not.
Let's get to the wild pig story.
We have to get to the wild pig.
I'll do this for just a couple minutes. A study published in the Journal of Applied Ecology found that the U.S. wild pig population is steadily growing and predicts that the animals could inhabit most counties in the continental U.S. within 3 decades. That could be another study for Yale. They could add
most
that to their
counties.
Yes. Wild boars, that's what they refer to too, wild pigs, wild boars, are most concentrated in the southern half of the country, where more than 6 million pigs are spread across 35 states.
Wow.
6 million. There's over a million in Florida, and I think Texas has, of course, the lead. They have a couple million wild pigs.
Wow.
The study noted that climate change could play a large role in their move and their migration. As things get warmer, they prefer warmer weather, so they're heading north. They're migrating north. They're migrating west. Studies authors wrote, we identify that climate change may assist spread into northern regions by generating mild winters with less snow. Now, hunters introduced wild Eurasian boars in the 1600s, where they went on to breed extensively with domestic pigs. And that's why you have this new, though we're not new, but this species of wild boar. The result is a modern invasive species that are known to carry or transmit over 30 diseases. So they're a vector of diseases. In addition, they just damage crops.
Right, and
they damage
ground and soil. I think they do a lot of soil disruption. So you kind of get more erosion and topsoil loss.
Yeah, topsoil loss. Native species are harmed. Habitats are damaged. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty aggressive in general, too. Now, most states have open policies as far as hunting them. It's a year-round hunt. You can go out. And actually, my friends have eaten them. It's wild boars. It's good meat.
Wow.
So there's plenty to go around, folks. There's 6 million of them and counting.
Wow.
This was from last month, so there's probably 6.1 now. So in 2014, Congress appropriated $20 million to the Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Inspection Service to create a damage measurement management program. The most effective way of controlling pigs is hunting them, stopping population growth. So that's the there's plenty of pigs. We need to more wild boar in our diet. Benefits just like eating lionfish.
That's right.
Benefits
the ecosystem, the native species.
So we can. It's okay to eat some more wild boar.
So have these been found in southern Utah yet? Is this a problem in our state?
I think there has been some sighted in the southern part of the state. They're
okay.
Actually through Texas, New Mexico, and if anything, they'll work their way up from the southern part of the state. But not large populations. We'll look into that.
All right.
We got
next time.
We got 2 minutes. Do you have a quick story?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I would love to share an event that's coming up at Swanner.
All right, let's do it.
We have a talk at the Eco Center called Why Did the Moose Cross the Road? Making Highway Crossings Safer for All. And we're doing this in conjunction with the local chapter of the Sierra Club here. And the speaker will be Patty Kramer, ecologist and researcher. And she's going to talk about her research regarding wildlife crossings here in the state. We know that we have potentially a highway overpass happening in our county in
just
the near future.
Just for critters.
Yeah, exactly, for wildlife. So we'll be talking about that and some of the other updates in this area. So that's coming up on the 22nd at 6:30 p.m. And you can register for that online through our website.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, let's take one last break now, and we'll come back and wrap up.
That's right.
It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Hey, next week, Brian McInerney for the National Weather Service is going to be joining us in the second part of the show. Of course, Brian comes on every 3 months or so to give us an update on all things weather and climate. So you won't want to miss that. His takeaways on this past winter's weather, the huge amount of snow we received and what that means to our watershed. So you want to listen in on that. But who's on the first half?
And during the first half of the show, we'll be speaking with Dan Egan, the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And he's a journalist that's been covering these lakes, yeah, for much of his career with the, I think, in Milwaukee. And it's a fascinating book about, you know, kind of where those lakes have come from and where they're heading and some of the challenges that they face.
I.e. plastic?
Plastic
perhaps,
is definitely
and micro
one of them.
Beads.
And nutrients. And,
there we go.
But incredible ecosystems. You know, they carry about 20% of the world's supply of fresh water just in that one system.
Unbelievable. So that's next week.
First
part
so that's
going to
be an interesting one.
Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah.
Republic Services.
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Park City Mountain.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties.
San Francisco Design.
You can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
Or you can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7